asanas, when done with the right intention, will help to transform an individual by taking the person away from an awareness of just the body toward the consciousness of the soul. Indeed, as I often say, body is the bow, asana the arrow, and soul is the target. You must fill every inch of your body with the asana, from your chest and arms and legs to the tips of your fingers and toes, so the asana radiates from the core of your body and fills the entire diameter and circumference of your limbs. You must feel your intelligence, your awareness, your consciousness in every inch of your body. It must be done with the right intention, not for ego or to impress, but for the self and to move closer to God. In this way, the asana is a sacred offering. We are surrendering our ego. This is supreme devotion to God, Ishwara Pranidhana. Vitality, the energy body. Everyone desires more life energy. If it could be packaged and sold in a shop, it would be the most successful business ever. We give many names to God, even though He is one. The same is true of energy. There is nuclear energy, electrical energy, muscular energy, mental energy. All of these are vital energy or life energy, called in Sanskrit pranic energy or simply prana. Prana is called qi in China. Some suggest that the nearest traditional concept of prana in the West is the Holy Spirit of Christianity, a sacred power which is both immanent and transcendent. Prana is also often called wind or vital air. The Bible begins its description of creation with the sentence, God's breath moved upon the waters. Prana is God's breath. Prana is the energy permeating the universe at all levels. It is physical, mental, intellectual, sexual, spiritual, and cosmic energy. Prana is the hidden and potential energy in all beings. It is energy which creates, protects, and destroys. Hindus often say that G-O-D is generator, organizer, and destroyer. Inhalation is the generating power. Retention is the organizing power. And the exhalation, if the energy is vicious, is the destroyer. This is prana at work. Vigor, power, vitality, life, and spirit are all forms of prana. Prana is usually translated as breath, yet this is only one of its manifestations. According to the Upanishads, it is the principle of life and consciousness. It is equated with the soul, Atman. It is the breath of life of all beings in the universe. They are born through it and live by it. And when they die, their individual breath dissolves into the cosmic breath. It is the most essential, real, and present feature of every moment of our lives, and yet it remains the most mysterious. It is yoga's job, and especially pranayama's, to enter into the heart of this mystery. Prana, in the form of breath, is the starting point. The suffix ayama means stretch, extension, expansion, length, breadth, regulation, prolongation, restraint, and control. Put in its simplest form, therefore, pranayama means the prolongation and restraint of breath. Since prana is energy and life force, pranayama means the extension and expansion of all our vital energy. For the inward journey, we will need a lot of energy and a very subtle, high-quality energy too. This never-ending exploration, occupation, and illumination requires the special energy of prana. Prana is special because it carries awareness. It is the vehicle of consciousness. If you want to send awareness to the furthermost cell of your big toe, prana will carry it there. When you have a sufficient flow of prana, you can spread your consciousness everywhere within. To do this, you need to generate a lot of prana. To generate prana, you must cultivate the extension, expansion, control, and restraint of your normal breath. Having strengthened our known selves through asana, we generate more energy. With more energy, we can explore and penetrate further and deeper within. In yoga philosophy, both energy, prana, and consciousness, chitta, are considered to evolve directly out of cosmic intelligence, Mahat. Mahat is the universal intelligence of nature. The rocks have universal intelligence. Every leaf has it. Every cell of every creature has it. It is all pervasive and infinite. The genius of nature's intelligence is self-expression. That is why nature is infinitely varied, infinitely inventive. Prana is our link to this infinite intelligence. What a shame it is that we have such access and ignore its use and development. We are like someone with a vast fortune locked in a numbered bank account who forgets the number and so must scrape by in poverty. We each live within our individual consciousness with its limited intelligence, often feeling lonely and puny when there's a conduit available directly to cosmic consciousness and intelligence. Through this conduit flows prana, joining each individual among us to the highest original principle of nature. Pranayama is about restoring this conduit so that the intelligence bearing the energy of the macrocosm can illuminate our microcosm. Breath and pranayama. Pranayama is not normal breathing, nor is it just deep breathing. It is the technique of generating cosmic vital energy through the fusion of the antagonistic elements of fire and water. Fire is the quality of mind, and water is the element that corresponds to the physiological body. Water douses fire, and fire evaporates water, so they are not easily brought together. Air is the interface whose flow in the lungs provides the dynamic stream which fuses water and fire and produces an energetic current of prana. This spreads through the nervous system and bloodstream and is distributed around the body, rejuvenating every cell. The earth element in the form of body provides the physical location for the production of energy, and the fifth and most subtle element, space or ether, offers the space required for the energy's distribution. The need for a harmonious and symmetrical space explains the importance of the spine and its supporting musculature, for the spine is the central column of the nervous system. By lifting and separating the 33 articulations of the vertebral column, and by opening the ribs from the spine like a tiger's claws, we deepen and lengthen the breath. Yogic breathing techniques are meditative in their origin and their effect. They basically consist of four parts. They are inhalation, purukha, retention of the breath after inhalation, antarkumbhaka, exhalation, rechaka, and retention after exhalation, baya kumbhaka. The in-breath should be long, subtle, deep, rhythmic, and even. The energizing ingredients of the atmosphere percolate into the cells of the lungs and rejuvenate life. By retaining one's indrawn breath, the energy is fully absorbed and distributed to the entire system through the circulation of blood. The slow discharge of air and exhalation carries out accumulated toxins. By pausing after the out-breath, according to one's capacity, all stresses are purged and drained away. The mind remains silent and tranquil. If you over-prolong the pause, you'll feel a sudden lurch of panic and suck in more air greedily. This is our instinctive attachment to life reasserting itself. Inhalation is the extension and expansion of the self, purusha. With the help of the in-breath, the self embraces its sheaths up to the skin of the body, like a lover embracing his beloved. Retention after inhalation is the union of the lover with his beloved. In exhalation, the self, via the out-breath, takes the beloved to his home where, in her turn, the beloved embraces her lover, the self. Retention after exhalation is the beloved uniting with the lover in total surrender to the Supreme. Hence, pranayama is more than a physiological breathing exercise. Because breath is life, the art of judicious, thoughtful, ungreedy breathing is a prayer of gratitude we offer to life itself. Pratyahara. In Sanskrit, Pratyahara literally means to draw towards the opposite. The normal movement of the senses is to flow outward where they encounter the objects of the world and name and interpret them with the aid of thought. These thoughts will probably be of acquisition, I want, rejection, I don't want, or resignation, there's nothing I can do about this. Rain, for example, will on different occasions elicit all three responses. Pratyahara then implies going against the grain, a difficult retraction, which is why it is often compared to a tortoise drawing his head, tail, and forelimbs back inside his shell. The yogi simply observes the fact. It is raining, he may think or say, without desire or judgment. You can see how difficult this is by the simple exercise of going for a walk and at the same time try not to comment on, judge, or even name what you see, hear, or smell. If you see a motor car, you may find the words new, beautiful, expensive, or ostentatious jumping unbidden into your mind. Even on a country walk, though you might not be able to stop yourself from saying beautiful or lovely as a commentary, it will be almost impossible not to let yourself name the objects, teak tree, cherry tree, violet, hibiscus, thorn bush, etc. We are not naturally receptive and polite. We do not let the sunset come to us and greet it with soft, receptive eyes. Our desire to control by description, interpretation, and consumption robs us of much of the scent, taste, and beauty of life. The ability to withdraw our senses and so control the noisy mind may sound like a killjoy, but in reality, it restores the pristine flavors, textures, and discoveries which we associate with the innocence and freshness of childhood. The yogic purpose of pratyahara is to make the mind shut up so that we can concentrate. As long as the senses pester us for their gratification, we will never get a moment to ourself, or in the sense of our inner quest, ourself. It is a long and patience-demanding apprenticeship and detachment. A witty man once joked that the only way to get rid of temptation was to give in to it. We all theoretically know the falsity of that, but simply to avoid giving in to desires does not of itself make desire go away. Most of us pretend to ourselves that when we have reasonable self-control, we have conquered desire. This is wishful thinking. The absence of vice is a step toward virtue, not virtue itself. Yoga situates the organ of virtue, dharmendriya, or conscience, in the heart, and it must be pure. Age, for example, may diminish our capacity for vicious action, but not for vicious thought or intention. Wars may be fought by young men, but they are started by old ones. Nor does retiring to a cave in the Himalayas make desires disappear. Far from it. It merely makes the gratification extremely problematic. Solitariness and simplicity of life do make us aware of desire as a mental phenomenon in itself, regardless of whether objects of sensory gratification are visible or available. The early Christian saint, Saint Anthony, underwent his great temptations in the Egyptian desert. They tormented him. By this austerity, he brought himself face to face with the root of desire itself. This sort of extreme practice has always been common in India, too. Patanjali recognizes the higher you rise, the harder you fall. Temptations of a quality one might even describe as celestial should come as no surprise to the higher practitioner, nor should he greet them with attachment. The sirens do not easily abandon their song. The nearer the victory, the more bitter the battle. Senses which have trained on greed are bound to suffer eventually from indigestion, so you have to make them go on a fast to rejuvenate them. In this way, we tame the senses and the mind, actually enhancing their intrinsic qualities. Because it is not extreme, there is no backlash. It is the gradual involution of the sense and stilling of the mind with the aid of the breath to make the practitioner fit for concentration and meditation. Involution means turning in. It is not rupture. A student once recited the phrase from a poem, "As though a rose should be shut and be a bud again." This is an apt description of pratyahara. The role of breath is capital for this reason. Consciousness, chitta, and vital energy, prana, are in constant association. Where consciousness is focused, there must be the energy of prana too. And where you direct the energy of prana, consciousness follows. Consciousness is propelled by two powerful forces, energy, prana, and desires, vasana. It moves in the direction of whichever force is most powerful. If breath, prana prevails, then desires are controlled, the senses held in check, and the mind pacified. If the force of desire gets the upper hand, the breathing becomes uneven and the mind becomes agitated. These are things you can actually observe, just as you observe right measure and balance in asana. And this is why and where the practice of yoga brings self-knowledge, swadhyaya. You will not reach knowledge of the divine self without passing through self-knowledge. Your practice is your laboratory, and your methods must become even more penetrating and sophisticated. Whether you are in asana or doing pranayama, the awareness of the body extends outwards, but the senses of perception, mind, and intelligence should be drawn inwards. This is pratyahara, where sustained practice, tapas, and self-knowledge, swadhyaya, blend together. Traditionally, self-knowledge starts with reading scriptures, knowing their meaning, and seeing their truths reflected in one's own life. This also includes the teachings of a wise master or guru. It continues and deepens through the self-culture of asana and pranayama practice, where one has to be able sensitively to verify differences in actions and make adjustments. Later on, one learns to watch the mind itself and its movements, and ultimately to keep it stable and quiet. But even here there's a danger, for when the mind and senses are controlled, the ego itself, like a cobra, raises its hood and hisses. The ego can become inflated, even intoxicated with its own prowess in mind control. Only the next petal of yoga, concentration, dharana, will release the knowledge which can truly be called wisdom. The sustained practice of pranayama liberates one from fear, including even the fear of death. If there is anxiety in the body, the brain contracts. When the brain relaxes and empties itself, it lets go of fears and desires. It dwells neither on the past nor the future, but inhabits the present. Freedom is about dropping the shackles of fear and desire. When freedom comes, there's no anxiety, no nervousness. That means there's no load on the nerves or through them on the unconscious mind. By removing tension from the inner layers of the nervous system, you convert them into a state of freedom. When we looked at pratyahara, we saw that freedom offers us choice, either to go on as before, driven by external forces and gratifications, or to turn inwards and use our gentle powers to seek out the self. Many ask me whether pranayama, controlling the breath, postpones old age. Why worry about it? Death is certain. Let it come when it comes. Just keep working. The soul has no age. It doesn't die. Only the body decays. And yet, we must never forget the body, since it is the garden we must cherish and cultivate. Even something as subtle as mind depends on health and energy. Clarity, the mental body. You cannot hope to experience inner peace or freedom without understanding the workings of your mind and of human consciousness in general. All behavior, both constructive and destructive, is dependent on our thoughts. With understanding of our mind, the door opens to clarity and wisdom. Mind and consciousness are considered to reside in the third and fourth sheaths of being. The yogi makes a distinction between the mental body, manomaya kosha, where the incessant thoughts of human life occur, and the intellectual body, vijnanamaya kosha, where intelligence and discernment can be found. The thinking brain, memory, ego, and sensory perception work together for good or for ill in our lives. The yogic definition of intelligence is making self-aware choices through informed discernment and the exercise of will. It is through this intelligence that we initiate change and free ourselves from ingrained patterns of behavior and steer ourselves incrementally towards illumination and freedom. Patanjali, in his Yoga Sutras, chooses to make the workings of mind and consciousness, both in success and in failure, the central theme of yoga philosophy and practice. His first sutra says, "Now I'm going to present the discipline code of ethical conduct, which is yoga." In other words, yoga is something you do. So what do you do? The second sutra tells us, "Yoga is the process of stilling the movements and fluctuations of the mind which disturb our consciousness." Everything we do in yoga is concerned with achieving this incredibly difficult task. If we achieve it, says Patanjali, then the goal and the fruit of yoga will be within our grasp. From one's very first samasthiti, standing still and straight, or tadasana, mountain pose, in one's very first class, one is embarking on this task. If one perseveres and refines, gaining strength and clarity, always penetrating from the initial practice, then the techniques of body and breath, which yoga offers, will lead us to reach the great goal which Patanjali has set. Yoga has precise definitions of mind and consciousness, and the English words we use do not always correspond well to the Sanskrit. I will explain them as I go along, but suffice to say that normal English usage often uses mind and consciousness synonymously. In the position of the Sanskrit, mind is described as an aspect or part of consciousness. The mind forms the outer layer of consciousness, citta, in the same way as the skeletal and muscular body is the outer sheath which contains the inner body of vital organs, circulatory and respiratory systems. Consciousness means our capacity to be aware both externally as well as internally, which we call self-awareness. One good image for consciousness is a lake. The pure waters of a lake reflect the beauty around it, external, and one can also see right through the clear water to the bottom, internal. Similarly, a pure mind can reflect the beauty in the world around it, and when the mind is still, the beauty of the self or soul is seen reflected in it. But we all know what stagnation and pollution do to a lake. As one has to keep the water of a lake clean, so it is yoga's job to clean and calm the thought waves that disturb our awareness. What then are the movements and fluctuations of the mind of which Patanjali writes? In the image of the lake, they are ripples and waves on its surface and currents and movements in its depths. We all recognize how odd thoughts ruffle the surface of the mind. Oh, I've forgotten to buy carrots. My boss doesn't like me. We notice how outside disturbances create inner ones. Their mindless chatter is making it impossible for me to concentrate. In yogic terms, mindless chatter, others or our own, is a lot of distracting ripples. So also do our desires, dislikes, jealousies, doubts, and fears erupt to the surface out of the mind and consciousness. Thoughts arising from memory are considered as a type of wave, as in sleep or daydreaming. Even ignorance is viewed as a type of movement in consciousness. A great many forces are constantly troubling the lake, muddying the waters and agitating the surface. We can see then that restoring our lake to a state of limpid, crystalline purity and tranquility is a huge undertaking. The inner workings of consciousness. Imagine a manual for a motor car which discusses endlessly and eloquently its bodywork, style, color, acceleration, comfort, and safety features, but which never actually gets down to how an internal combustion engine works. From such a description, no one could ever understand, maintain, or mend their car. Fortunately, we can take our car to the garage where the engine is fully understood and can be repaired. But to whom do we take our own individual mind to get it fixed? We can go to a psychologist for advice, but in the end, we are eternally obliged to fix it ourselves. Yoga offers us very useful ways to fix the mental problems that cause most of us so much suffering. Yoga identifies three constituent parts to our consciousness, which it calls citta. They are mind, which is called manas, ego or self with a small s, which is called ahamkara, and intelligence, which is called buddhi. The mind is the outer layer of consciousness. Its nature is fickleness, unsteadiness, and inability to make productive choices. It cannot decide between good and bad, right or wrong, correct or incorrect. This is the role of the intelligence, which is the inner layer. Ahamkara, or ego, is the innermost layer of consciousness. Literally, ahamkara means I shape. It presents itself as our personality and assumes the identity of the true self. Yoga points out how we generally react to the outside world by forming entrenched patterns of behavior that doom us to relive the same events endlessly, though in a superficial variety of forms and combinations. Anyone who looks at history or listens to the litany of woe and war on the daily news will bear this out. Does mankind never learn anything, we ask in exasperation? The historical change from killing with stone clubs to swords to guns to nuclear weapons is clearly no change at all, and certainly not evolution. There is nevertheless a chance that we can break free from this imprisoning past and individually train ourselves to control this reactive mechanism in such a way that the old patterns are not repeated. New things truly can happen, and real changes can, in fact, take place. This dawning clarity is, in essence, the path of yoga. The paradox arises in that to train ourselves to achieve this, we have to start by doing a fair bit of what we don't want to do, and rather less of what we think we do want. Yoga calls this tapas, which I have translated as sustained, courageous practice. The French philosopher Descartes said happiness does not consist in acquiring the things we think will make us happy, but in learning to like doing the things we have to do anyway. Try this when you're waiting for a late train or doing the dishes. Sanskara, freeing yourself from habit. If consciousness is like a lake, there are primary waves or fluctuations of consciousness on the surface of the lake. These are easily discernible. An example is, if you're invited to dinner by dear friends, and at the last minute they ring to cancel, then you're very disappointed. That is a primary wave on the surface of the lake. You're disappointed, you're unhappy, you feel let down, and you deal with that on the surface. You have to calm yourself down, get over your disappointment. That is a challenge, an external challenge, as it were, that causes a ripple on the surface. The secondary fluctuations or waves are different. Those are the ones that rise up from the bottom of the lake. The bottom of the lake is covered in sand, and so, if in life you experience a sufficient number of disappointments, the ripple on the surface creates a wave which goes down to the bottom, and imperceptibly that ripple creates a little bank in the sand, so there's a little mound of disappointment. As a result, you will find yourself frequently disappointed or sad, as this mound at the bottom sends off secondary fluctuations or waves. Let us look at another common example. If you constantly find yourself being irritable, annoyed by something, annoyed by your wife, your children, or parents, or annoyed by anything at all, a sufficient number of irritable reactions will create imperceptibly, not in one time only, a little mound of irritability at the bottom of the lake of consciousness, and that will eventually make you what we call an irritable person, an angry person. If you have smoked since you were 16, every time you pick up a cigarette during the day, you are also brainwashing yourself. In this situation, I pick up a cigarette, sends a little ripple down through consciousness, which adds to the take a cigarette mound. That is why cigarettes are more difficult than almost anything else to give up. Aside from their physical cravings, we create mental cravings because the habit is very repetitive. The habit of smoking puts itself into every situation. The triggers to that situation are so many that many smokers still sometimes want to smoke even years after they've stopped because the mound is still there. When you have an anger, irritability, or disappointment mound, the conditioned reflex works like this. Supposing you're irritable with your parents and your mother comes into the room. She might only say, "Dinner's ready," but the irritability reflex is ready to spring up. She has said nothing to irritate you, but the irritability mound means that any incoming stimulus connected to her sends a wave down through the lake, and it hits the irritability mound. So we get a distorted and secondary wave of bad-tempered thought bouncing up from the floor of the lake. the accumulated predisposition to bad temper rears up and says, "Oh, it's my mother. She's so irritating." And even though she's only announced dinner, you reply, "Oh, all right. I'm coming. I'm coming." There's an irritation in the response that isn't warranted. This often happens between husband and wife. The same predisposition occurs whether you're talking about a smoking habit or about accumulated disappointment. Somebody who has encountered a great deal of disappointment, who has got that mound, in any situation, is likely to feel predisposed to disappointment. When something happens, they don't say, "Oh, this could be good. Let's see how this turns out." They say, "Oh, dear. I don't know. This is going to go wrong." That's the disappointment wave sending off a secondary reflex thought of unjustified negativity. As these things are built up over time, they can only be removed over time. It's not because you give up smoking for a day, or you guard your tongue and don't snap at your wife for a day, or you say, "Yes, I'll look on the bright side of life," that you remove the mound at the bottom of the lake that has been built up over probably many years or even your whole life. By now, it's a big mound sending out powerful waves which are nevertheless difficult to detect. The practice of yoga is about reducing the size of subliminal mounds and setting us free from these and other fluctuations or waves in our consciousness. Everybody aspires to be free. No one wants to be manipulated by unseen forces. But effectively, the banks of sanskara and the dark depths of the unconscious do just that. As stimuli from the conscious surface travel rapidly down through the levels of the lake, they encounter uncharted banks of sediment which cause secondary waves of thought. These, in turn, stimulate, in a way which is beyond our comprehension or control, behavior which is both reactive and inappropriate. Our reactions are preconditioned and therefore unfree. We cannot break out of the old pattern of behavior, however much we long to. In the end, we may accept the situation and just say, "It's the way I am. Life always lets me down. Things just make me so angry." Or, "I have an addictive personality." If you don't smoke for one day, you actually take away from the smoking sandbank at the bottom of the lake, so the sandbank is fractionally smaller. But the second day you don't smoke, you still want to smoke, because you've got a one-day I-don't-smoke mound and a 24-year I-do-smoke mound. Obviously, it is through the continued practice of creating I-don't-smoke, I-am-not-disappointed, or I-don't-get-irritable mounds that little by little we reform ourselves. We diminish the size of the negative mounds and turn them into positive sanskara, such as, "I'm a non-smoker, I'm good-natured, I am equable." Then you build up banks of good nature, bonhomie, openness, non-smoking, or whatever you want. These form a good character and they make our life much easier. Somebody with good habits of life is an agreeable person, able to make his way in life. This is a reward from practice, from cleanliness, contentment, from a process of self-reform which you can undertake even without yoga. Yoga is a support to it, obviously. Yoga is a way to it. But that doesn't mean there's no reform of sanskara outside of yoga. However, yoga is a powerful tool for liberating ourselves from unwanted, ingrained patterns. Through it, we identify, acknowledge, and progressively change them. What is unique to yoga is an ability to take us further to an unconditioned freedom, because yoga sees even good habits as a form of conditioning or limitation. Yoga never forgets that the end purpose is not just to remove bad sanskara. We also have to cultivate good deeds to build up good sanskara. Of course, we first have to weed out the bad. But the yoga compass always returns to the notion of emancipation. So what we want is for the bottom of the lake to be flat, so that we don't get any secondary fluctuations bouncing off the bottom. That is freedom. But practically speaking, you can't go from bad sanskara in one jump to freedom. You've got to go from bad sanskara to good sanskara to freedom. It's a logical progression. It's doable. Theoretically, you could go from bad to total redemption, and there may be cases where this happens, but it would be very rare. In practical terms, most of us have built up negative habits. You want to turn them into positive habits and then into no habits. As progress reaches into the subtle layers of kosha, you don't avoid smoking because you're a non-smoker or because smoking is bad. You are not invoking a duality of good versus bad. Similarly, you do not have to bite off your tongue to avoid giving an angry retort to people who irritate you. You're not being self-consciously good. It simply becomes second nature to be free. You might give an angry answer to a rude person. You might give a courteous answer to a rude person. But either way, you act in freedom. You act appropriately, unconditioned by the past. Suppose you've always eaten too much chocolate. Then you give it up for a long time and free yourself from chocolate. Later on, if someone offers you some chocolate, you can actually say yes or no to the chocolate, but you know that if you pick up a piece of chocolate and eat one piece, you won't have to buy the whole chocolate shop to satisfy a craving which is still dormant within you. You can touch it lightly and say, "Great, that's enough." But you're not caught, so you're acting in freedom. That gives you moderation and lightness, and you're dealing with the situation as it is. You're not a prisoner of past badness or past goodness. This has significant karmic implications. Everybody wants to have what is called good karma rather than bad, so we're trying to make karmic consequences less unpleasant. Pleasant effects derive from positive sanskara. So build these up and you get good consequences. This makes life pleasant, livable, agreeable for us and for others. There's a real social benefit, but the yogic goal is freedom. So the yogi says, "I want to be free of consequence. I want to be free of karmic causality. Let me act in the present, unconditioned even by the good imprints bringing good results. I will try to cultivate actions so they are reaction-free." He will not be tied either to the past or, through self-interested motivation, to the future. He will simply act cleanly in the present. If we understand the relationship between sanskara and karma of actions and their consequences, we can break the chain of causality. The advantage of sustained and dedicated practice over time, tapas, is that it creates lasting results. What we do over time removes what we have created over time. We cannot leap to freedom in one bound or one immersion in a holy river. This is a dream, an illusion. Resurfacing ego will always grab us back. The immersion is a beginning and a declaration of good intent. We wash away our stains and heal our wounds and frailties over many minutes, in many hours, in many years of sustained, mindful application. Nevertheless, even beginners can move rapidly from debit to credit, and the quality of life can change significantly for the better. Presence of mind, self-control, and creative direction embrace us, and we gain the strength to persevere in the face of remaining adversities. Whether one agrees with the technicalities of karma causality or not, everyone desires progressively to raise the threshold of their intelligence and to reap the benefits. This is a sort of karmic moving staircase, an impulse towards moving up and fear of the consequences of moving down. We must be careful, however, that the idea of progress does not project us into a future which never comes. The point we are seeking to reach is where we can act directly in the present. Direct action stems from direct perception, the ability to see reality in the present as it is without prejudice and act accordingly. This is what it truly means to live in the present moment. If we perceive and act in the present, then we are coming closer to the yogic ideal of what is called an action without taint or without color. Actions are either black, which means they are entirely rooted in selfish motivations and lead to painful consequences, or white, disinterested and good, or like most actions, gray, in that they stem from mixed motives and therefore bring mixed results. That's the normal way of the world. The yogic action is an action which is absolutely unfettered by past habit and without desire for personal reward in the future. It is the right thing in this present moment just because it is right and is colorless or taint-free. Its great benefit is that you can act in the world without creating reaction. The benefit of that for a yogi in relation to freedom is that he's trying to free himself from the karmic wheel of becoming. The yogi wants to get off the merry-go-round of cause and effect. He knows that pleasure leads to pain and pain to pleasure in an endless cycle. It is an exhilarating ride, and the goal for most people is to eliminate the pain and experience only pleasure. The yogi knows this is impossible and takes the radical solution of transcending the endless chain of causality. He does not cease to engage in life, on the contrary, but he can act without being tainted. That is why we say his actions are without taint or color. And it is only possible when the ego which rides on the merry-go-round ceases to impersonate the soul. The soul is always outside the game of life, a seer, not a player. And so when the ego-based human consciousness loses its identity in the soul, it can no longer be ensnared in pains and pleasures. The ego is then understood to be no more than an actor's mask for the true self. Few people have ever reached this level of detachment. Humanity lives for the most part in gray actions with mixed results, but nurtures an ethical resolve gradually to shift from gray to white. What impedes the self-reforming process is that we have little awareness, let alone control, of the waves of thought which arise in the depths of the unconscious. Few of us possess the clarity and dexterity to catch the currents that arise from ingrained habits and conditioned reflexes. Yet if we understood the complex role of memory, we are more likely to use it skillfully and act with greater awareness and freedom. Memory, liberation or bondage. When Pavlov rang his bell for the dogs at mealtimes, the dogs salivated because the bell hit a bell equals mealtime mechanism in them, associating with and triggering memory. The bell triggered the time to eat response, and salivation occurred instantly. The dog didn't say, "Wait a minute, this is a secondary wave. This is only a bell." It is very difficult for us to pick up the secondary wave rising from the unconscious toward the surface. We are caught up in the action which it provokes, both like salivation at a physical and sensorial level, or at the level of doing something. Salivating is an action. We are caught up in the consequence before we can interrupt it. For example, sex or violence in films acts like this on us. Even if we dislike or disapprove of them at a conscious level, they create secondary waves from unconscious sexual or aggression sandbags, which muddy the waters of consciousness. Only someone who is completely free of causality is beyond the dangers of pollution. The advertising business is largely based on the trick of triggering a response in the customer's unconscious mind. Our consciousness increasingly becomes what we feed it. It's very difficult to be aware of these secondary waves rising. We always think that we are reacting in a certain situation to the primary stimulus, the ruffle on the surface of consciousness. But in fact, far more than we can ever realize, we are reacting to the predisposition which is in the samskara at the bottom of the lake. Consumers buy products without knowing what it is that has unconsciously motivated them to do so. We think we're acting in freedom. We convince ourselves that we are, but in reality, we are manipulated or influenced by these waves. The word influence comes from the Latin to flow in, which shows that their language understood thought as a current or wave. The yogi wants to see and act directly, so he needs a flat bottom lake in order to act solely in response to the stimulus that comes from outside and that is on the surface. How do we catch secondary waves coming up from the floor of consciousness? Let us say you are driving a car and a small absent-mindedness or selfishness on the part of another driver releases a wave of anger in you. Before you know it, you are honking your horn, cursing and driving aggressively yourself. Does it do any good? Do you feel better for letting your serenity be so easily shattered? Does blaming the other driver restore your peace of mind? No. If you want to intercept the secondary waves rising, you need speed and clarity of perception, an acute self-awareness. If your lake is muddy, impure, if there are lots of toxins in your system clouding your vision, clarity of vision is impossible. If your liver is sluggish with toxins, your brain will be impaired because the liver is not filtering the blood. Your nervous system will be slow to react to danger, but disproportionate in the degree of stress it registers. To gain health, you have to know the unconscious mind, which expresses itself within the nervous system. If the nerves are disturbed, you feel the weakness of the mind. As long as the nerves are strong, stable, and elastic, the mind is stable. When the mind is stable, the sediment held in suspension, which clouds it, sinks to the bottom, and the consciousness becomes limpid. Cleanliness and contentment are bound together. As we shall see, they are the first two ethical injunctions of niyama concerning our behavior towards ourselves. As yoga practice cleans the system and rests the nerves, clarity, contentment, and serenity establish themselves. Contentment means the thought waves in the lake of consciousness are less turbulent. You are starting to bring about Patanjali's statement, yoga is about stilling the turbulence of consciousness. Someone who is clouded, toxic, sluggish, discontented, blaming others is a prime cause of discontent and restive in mind, is never going to catch a secondary wave coming to the surface. It will have expressed itself in action before they even notice it. It is through the acute awareness and speed of action that we cultivate in asana and pranayama that we can reform ourselves. In addition, by breathing before acting, we are able to slow down our response, inhale divinity, and surrender ego in our exhalation. This momentary pause allows us the time for cognitive reflection, corrective reaction, and reappraisal. It is the momentary pause in the process of cause and effect which allows us to begin the process of freedom. The endless process is breath, cognitive reflection, corrective reaction, reappraisal, and action. Eventually, this process blends together in such a manner that we discover we have pulled ourselves into the present moment. No past, no future, but action and right perception sought it together in a peerless moment, and then another moment, and another. Eventually, we are no longer caught up in the movement of time as a sequence or current sweeping us along, but experience it as a series of discrete and present moments. No rising thought wave can escape the sharpness of such vision. It is what we call presence of mind. Great sportsmen possess it at the level of the body's intelligence. They seem to have so much more time to act than other players. It's as if the game slows down around them and they can dominate it as they please. Asana and pranayama teach us how unsolicited thought throws us off balance. Take the standing pose Ardha Chandrasana, half moon asana, balancing on one leg, the other horizontal, arm extended upwards. We get the balance, but the moment the thought arises, oh wonderful, I'm doing it, we wobble or topple. Only in stillness of mind can it be successfully maintained. Similarly, in pranayama, we see how breath and consciousness interact. A disturbance or irregularity in one creates its counterpart in the other. When breath is calmed and attention focused on its inward movement, then consciousness is no longer jerked by outer stimuli. Similarly, if the consciousness is steady and stable, the breath moves with rhythm. Either way, it is receptive and passive, no more hungrily seeking distraction or entertainment. This frees it to let its attention gravitate towards the most profound level of consciousness in the depths of the lake. Normally, this level appears as our unconscious, as no light of awareness penetrates it. But if the lake is clear, no rising wave can catch us by surprise. There's no mystery here. It's about training, self-education. If we learn reflection and correction and equipoise, where any movement or alteration is detectable and its source revealed, then we have acquired the sensitivity which brings self-knowledge, the threshold of wisdom. We know when we are reacting to an external challenge in a straightforward manner, or when the hidden sandbags of previous conditioning are trying to influence and warp our response. We can now identify thought as a deliberative, useful, and necessary process, a great gift and a talent apart from thought as meaningless disturbance, mindless chatter, a radio we cannot switch off, and also from thought as a subtle form of interference from the past, a self-sabotaging mechanism lodged in our unconscious memory. We have looked at the process of turning negative habits into positive ones as a prelude to the larger freedom of unalloyed, moment-to-moment perception and wisdom. But one might legitimately ask the question, what happens if a negative sandbank has been created in unconscious memory by a single past event, such as a traumatic accident 10 years ago, the spontaneous recall of which may continue to trouble the present as latent, hidden impressions resurface? There is no countervailing positive sandbank we can build up, and so we would seem to be imprisoned by an unchangeable past incident lodged in memory. We are not. Everything I have said about strengthening the nervous system and stabilizing the mind holds good. In addition, there's the old nostrum, time heals. It does, but only if we allow it to. In Western psychology, one recites and reflects repeatedly on one's problems. This rumination reinforces and exacerbates the problem. While revelation can help one to see the samskara, rumination only continues to reinforce it. We all know that a scab which we constantly pick will not heal. In the same way, we have to let old wounds in memory heal over. This does not mean repressing them. It means that what is not fed will wither. A sandbank which we do not add to will gradually erode. The right practice of yoga speeds this process by enabling one to identify the impulses arising from the old imprint and by severing the mechanism that feeds it. Acting on subliminal impulses reinforces them, and so the ability to intercept the rising wave is itself a progressive means of relief. As the rising impulse is stopped before causing a disturbance in our consciousness, we stop it from making a ripple on the surface that will, in addition, return to reinforce the sandbank at the bottom. This principle applies to yoga's treatment of all addictions, too. What we don't feed will wither. Desires, even if only expressed at a mental level, continue to nourish negative imprints. By turning our mind inward, which automatically happens in asana and pranayama, and teaching us the art of constructive action in the present moment, yoga leads consciousness away from desires and towards the inner, undisturbable core. Here, it creates a new avenue by which reflexively to perceive, observe, and recognize the heart. In this way, the meditative mind, created by yoga, is a powerful therapeutic tool for removing human ills. Memory is not a platform from which to review the world. It is a ladder whose rungs we ascend step by step. Memory is absolutely necessary for the development of intelligence. Only when intelligence, buddhi, consults memory can it get at the information it needs to initiate the transformation it seeks. While mind reacts to memory, intelligence interrogates memory. Intelligence can conduct a thorough interrogation of memory to discern consequences and make connections that mind, manas, shies away from as they are too uncomfortable. The Bhagavad Gita says that without memory, intelligence cannot prosper, so we cannot reach our soul. It is the way we use memory which is crucial, and above all, which element of consciousness conducts the interview. It must be intelligence with its power to extract the truth, reflect, and act innovatively, overriding even the mulish, recalcitrant ego. Memory, consulted by intelligence, gives completely different answers to memory consulted by mind. As we have seen, memory consulted by mind and ego will always say, "What I liked, give me more of, whatever the consequences. What I didn't like, give me none of, whatever the consequences." Mind and memory reinvoke past experiences of pain and pleasure and equate them to the present situation, however inappropriate. Whereas intelligence makes creative comparisons, mind makes destructive ones. Destructive in the sense that they fix us in a rut, an imprisoning pattern. Memory is useful if it helps to prepare you for the future, to know whether or not you are moving forward. Use it to develop. Memory is useless if it brings about a repetition of the past. Repetition means to live in memory. If repetition is taking place, then memory retards the path of evolution. Do not live in memory. Memory is only the means to know whether we are fully aware and evolving. Never think of yesterday. Only go back if you feel that you're doing something wrong. Use yesterday's experience as a springboard. Living in the past or longing to repeat previous experience will only stagnate intelligence. But what of the memory of the body? Does that also, like its conscious counterpart in the mind, have the capacity to enslave us or to set us free? It does. And here again, the awakening of intelligence is critical. Consciousness is potentially in every cell of our body, but most of us are comatose. The nervous system reaches everywhere. Where nerves are, mind must be. Where mind is, so is memory. Any repetitive, skillful action depends on that memory. The potter's memory is in his hands. When we drive a familiar winding road, we know instinctively how to take the bends. We do not think consciously at all. In a new stranger's house, we can never find the light switches. In our own, our hand goes to them automatically. Sense and taste recall scenes of childhood to us without the intervention of mind. The cellular memory also provokes negatives. "I don't want to do that. It's too much trouble. I don't like him. He looks like my boss." Again, it is practice which brings the light of intelligence to ourselves and roots out negativity. Stretching brings the conduits of the nervous system from the center to the periphery, strengthening and relaxing them. Through these conduits, nadis, there is a spread of awareness. Awareness is consciousness. Intelligence is a part of consciousness, and so its light is reaching every cell in areas which previously were dull and unknown to us. We hear a lot about illumination of the soul. This is illumination of the body. Our cells die by the million every minute, but at least if we bring life to them, they live before they die. When intelligence shines into the cells, then instinct is joined by the higher faculty of intuition. Instinct is memory and mind functioning for good or ill with reference only to the past, life-preserving and life-destroying jumbled together. When intelligence is awakened in the cells, then instinct is transformed into intuition, and the past loses its deterministic grip on us, as our inner intelligence tells us what the future requires. Memory at the cellular level is at the service of intelligence in the form of intuition. At the conscious level, it serves initially as a reference library for intelligence, to be consulted judiciously and with scholarly detachment. When intelligence consults spontaneously with memory at each moment, then conscious intuition arises. And the word we give to conscious intuition is wisdom. There's another subtle way in which memory influences our lives without our realizing it. The imprints of memory at an unconscious level act as a filter to perception. Intelligence strives to see things as they are, but mind and memory tend to interpret these in relation to the past. The effect of this is imperceptibly to construct sandbanks of prejudice. We are all aware how prejudice acts retrospectively. You see something and place a distorted value judgment on it. But prejudice also projects itself into the future. by which I mean that it influences us to see and therefore to experience only those things which will confirm what we already think. That is why I say it acts as a filter, eliminating anything which